has responsibilities to respond to those problems, and it is not out of order for the church and the state to work together collaboratively to deal with these questions. But when you start to deal with the state, as Krausch would tell you, you make lots of compromises. You never quite get everything you'd like. You don't design the program in sort of pure lines of the best moral answer. You often have mixed answers. So some feel that the large-scale collaboration of our healthcare and charitable institutions with the state itself compromises Catholic identity, Christian identity, compromises it. Because the argument is, how can you possibly expect that a secular state responsive to a pluralistic constituency, with all that that means, is ever going to live up to the gospel? So if you collaborate with it, aren't you collaborating with something that's always going to be less than satisfactory? So we locate ourselves in a big church model. But there are ways in which, on both issues, we get pushed, in a sense, by the logic of issues into what are much closer to prophetic positions, even as we play the big church model. Certainly in the healthcare debate today, it has become, unfortunately, literally a prophetic proposition to support universal healthcare. To support universal healthcare for every American citizen is something that virtually no member of the US Congress is prepared to do at the present time. After the debate in the early 90s, which was the fifth try to get universal coverage for healthcare for every American citizen, after that debate, that proposition has been regarded as almost a third rail of American politics. Because the cost seems daunting. So therefore the debate is really all about marginal, incremental changes of an existing system. Portability of health care. You can take it with you from job to job. Let's cover children. Let's not cover everybody, but let's cover children, because children really make people guilty. So, I mean, if you can say you're going to turn down health care for children, that probably won't get you beaten in an election. But if you say healthcare for everybody, it's just a third rail. Prescription drugs, because that focuses on a voting population. Now, there's nothing wrong with those three things, but they are marginal, incremental changes in a healthcare system where we are now up to 40 million people without any basic healthcare coverage. And we hold a moral position that says that healthcare is essentially related to human dignity, and therefore healthcare is not a need, it's a right. It is a moral claim that a society has a responsibility to fulfill. Now notice what you've done. You locate the healthcare institutions of Catholicism in a big church model. They're part of the system. They play in the system. They have to play by the same rules as other people. But by holding on to one proposition, you become a prophetic voice. Prophetic here may mean no one will ever hear you, because right at the present minute, it is very difficult to generate any large-scale support for this proposition. That is not the only thing we say about healthcare, but by saying it, a sort of mainstream institution has been pushed in a prophetic direction. Let me turn my final point on this, and that is abortion and capital punishment. Both of these issues, now position us in prophetic posture in the American political system. Just the uttering of the basic position we hold on both of them places us where the Mennonites usually expect to find themselves on War and Peace. That is to say, at the margin of the society. So you have a big church, I don't mean big simply in terms of numbers, I mean big meaning fit into the wider society, find the consensual position, work it out, compromise. You've got a big church with marginal positions in the American political process. For if you take simply the standard, I don't mean any particularly radical view, simply the standard consensual teaching at the present minute, that direct intentional killing of fetal life is wrong, and that the legal system should, on the whole, protect that proposition, that proposition is a marginal proposition in terms of much of American political life today. And therefore, we are faced, holding that proposition, to resort to Mennonite tactics about living in the society. We have to negotiate conscience clauses for our institutions and conscience clauses for individuals. Why? Because the broader social consensus runs in a very different direction. So just as you need conscientious objection to protect a Mennonite's view when you go to war, you need conscientious objection clauses in this arena also. Capital punishment often is an issue for a different part of the political spectrum, but once again, this position as it is held today, and it is held differently today in Catholicism than it was held under Pius XII, so again, like warfare, there's been change. But the proposition that capital punishment is not a necessary instrumentality in this society, that one can defend the society, if broadly speaking, in both its moral needs and its security needs without resort to capital punishment, and the subordinate argument that the use of capital punishment by the state, in fact, erodes respect for life in the society, that is a proposition that is a minority proposition in the Roman Catholic Church. It is the consensual teaching position for the minute, but minority. So in that sense, we look like prophetic in the specific sense, even though we are advocating a proposition that is prophetic in the broad sense. Well, let me finally come to a very different set of reflections and then open myself to what you will do with me. And that is the question that I raised earlier about the internal life of the church and its external manifestation. The first point to be made about this was it was a non-issue until after Vatican II. We simply were at the other pole of what the sectarian Mennonite position ecclesiologically always was. A good, strong sectarian Mennonite thinks of the social teaching of the church as prophetic for the church. The audience is the church to teach it how to live in a society that does not share its assumption. We always thought the social teaching was what the church said to the wider society about how it should live. The question about turning the social teaching inside the church is of relatively recent vintage for us. And so you find in 1974 this sort of wonderful statement that says, if the church itself is to be just, if the church is to teach justice, it itself must be just. Its internal life is part of its witness to the society. Seems self-evident, but the fact is the first time you hear it is not 1971. It's not 1974, it's 1971. So the text itself is new, and we've been grappling with it on and off on a variety of issues. But those issues have been, if I can put it in this way, those issues have been trying to better our existence. We try to be more just by paying better wages. We try to be more just by being more faithful to our teaching on unions within our own institution. We try to be more just in terms of looking at the position of women in the church. In other words, it's an aspirational dynamic that was set loose from the 1970s. At the present minute, American Catholicism is not dealing with aspirational dynamics. We are dealing with something that responds better to the language of scandal and sin. We are dealing with what U.S. News and World Report said last week is a cancer sapping the moral authority, the public trust, and the financial resources of the Catholic Church. We are dealing, as Scott Appleby from Notre Dame said, with a danger that if we cannot get our own house in order, the possibility of being a moral voice in the society in either the broad or the specific sense is negligible. So that is our fate at the present minute. It is not about aspiration. It is about rooting out corruption. There are five dimensions, in my view, to this problem. You'll be happy to know they will all be two sentences and not played out. But there is a moral view, there's a moral dimension, a legal dimension, an administrative dimension, theological, juridical dimension, and a pastoral dimension. That is the depth of this issue. The moral dimension is this is about sin. It is also about sickness, and abuse of children can be described psychologically, and the more we know about the psychology, the better off we'll be because we haven't known enough about it. But it's also about sin. It is about great evil done to other human beings. And great evil done to vulnerable human beings. And so the church ought to talk about it in a language that is not only psychological. There is here, objectively at least, sin, and of a great order, and we ought to acknowledge that. Secondly, it is a sin that is a crime, so it is a legal dimension. The church's responsibility here is not just to itself, it is to the wider civil society. We are a threat to the wider civil society in the way we have handled this case. We have placed into society threatening individuals and not warned anybody. And so that is not simply a failure of the moral order, it is a failure of the legal order. And we have to be accountable to those who do not share our conceptions of faith or what we might hope to be as the church, but have a right to be able to demand that we meet minimal legal obligations. Thirdly, it is an administrative problem in the sense that our failure to address it effectively in the first two levels has been due in part to our way of addressing it. This has not been universally true. The problem we have, in part, is that we have a very pluralist system of addressing this question nationally, and I don't think we can afford pluralism anymore. We need a universal policy that people are held to, and as they would say in governmental structures, we need a transparent structure. A transparent structure that can be analyzed from the outside, precisely because the outside society has an interest in what we are about. There is a theological, juridical set of questions about whether there are a whole set of issues surrounding the way we think about sexuality and ministry and church life that contribute to this issue or not. Now here, I think these are large and broad questions, and if you just take three issues, homosexuality, pedophilia, and celibacy, the degree of confusion that operates around those three terms and the way they are brought into relationship with each other, both inside and outside the church, is testimony to the fact that these questions are not easily dealt with. But there are theological and juridical issues that bear upon ministry, sexuality, life in the church, what has been called a culture surrounding these issues. And finally, there is the pastoral dimension. Pastoral dimension is about the consequences of these issues. And the pastoral dimension, in my view, runs at two levels. The first level is the arena of the parish, where people are directly engaged and connected with their life of faith. There has been an explosion in the church, and what we have to watch out for is erosion that could follow the explosion, that people are driven to disconnect because of this issue. The polling data and the anecdotal data illustrates that that seems not to be the case for many people. They are angry, confused, disappointed, scandalized, but they say, I'm not going to leave. And that is good news, but we ought not take it for granted. We need conscious efforts to prevent that kind of disconnecting that can go on. Finally, to tonight's talk, there is the public arena, not the sort of authority and connectedness between a believer and his or her church, but the public role of the church in this society. What connects the pastoral issue with the public issue is the factor of trust. Unless you're trusted, people will neither listen to your teaching nor think you have anything to tell them that is worthwhile saying. So the public arena is the possibility that the internal life of the church could eviscerate its possibility for effective moral witness. And to some degree, while the first one, the question of the parishes, we have some data on, the second one we don't have any data on. We don't know what this has done to our capacity for public moral discourse. We may find it out, I or somebody else, before some congressional committee when we make a great transcendent statement and some tough congressman sits you on your ear and tells you that it would be better if you spent more time getting your own house in order than telling him how the country ought to be run. That is a distinct possibility as we try to deal with what was before self-evidently taken as our responsibility to speak publicly and morally to the country. My view is, of course, we can't give up on this one, but we ought to figure that we're pretty much close to square one and have to build our way back. That brings the final proposition I will make, and that is that the prophetic witness, broadly defined and specifically defined, is one way that we might be able to help restore trust, credibility inside the church and out. That is to say that we ought to demonstrably in a sense, almost in the sense of doing penance, be the protector of the vulnerable, the compassionate care of those who need care, a clear kind of moral voice done with modest humility on the difficult issues I've talked about. Slowly, over time, we've got to hope that we can get people to look at us again, listen again, and believe not only that we can be trusted, but that we have something to say in the great prophetic tradition of what the church might say to the society. Thank you very much.
He says he doesn't want any more.
This man's never amazing. Touch the stuff.
We have some time for some questions, and why don't we call on you? I wanted to give him at least 30 seconds to take a break, so I'm just making up things here just to give him a brief moment, but please, questions, comments?
Have they turned off the heat?
It was not, today was a holiday here at Boston College, and you know, I'm so glad that so many of you could come on this, but it does mean that we're lacking things like a lectern and heat and so on. Go ahead.
This is a question that you might not be able to answer, but do you think Cardinal Law should be served?
What a surprise.
You're right. It is a question I don't think is appropriate for me to answer. I don't think it is appropriate for me to answer. The question is, should the cardinal resign?
Oh.
And I don't think it is appropriate for me to do that. I'm going to ask you to repeat that again, just because I'm not sure. Well, first of all, let me say the fact that it might not be appropriate for me to say something doesn't mean it's not appropriate for anybody to say something. I stand in a very particular relationship to Cardinal Law, and that has something to do with, relationship because I'm a priest of this diocese, and I'm in the service of this diocese. So it doesn't mean that it wouldn't be appropriate for somebody else to speak to that issue as opposed to me. There's a way that office holds certain kinds of limitations. That is to say, my two great examples of this, I'll come to your question about what ought to say, but my two great examples of this are Bob McNamara and Cyrus Vance, two very, very close people who dealt with things very differently. McNamara, for the last year and a half of his tenure in office, disagreed with Johnson on the war. His view was that Johnson was elected and he wasn't, and therefore if he was going to oppose the war, he had to step out of being Secretary of Defense, because the office made it inappropriate for him to hold that office and speak. Vance, I think, agreed with that proposition, but when Vance became Secretary of State and the issue on the table was whether we should try to rescue the hostages in Iran, Vance opposed that position in principle. So before the attack, Vance wrote his letter of resignation. So he said to the president, I won't oppose you publicly, but I'm going to resign whether you succeed or fail, because I think it's wrong in principle. That's a way of fulfilling responsibilities of office. You have definite responsibility. You can step out of the office, but if you're going to stay in it, there are bonds that tie you to a certain posture. Now, the question is, what's appropriate to talk about? And why would anybody want him to resign? Why would anybody want Cardinal to resign? Well, I think some people use standard principles of what you do with social institutions. And therefore, say, if you have a company and something like this happens, if you have a university and something like this happens, major scandal on the watch, that you have to clear the air. You have to clear the air. Some mistakes can be overcome from within. Other mistakes are of such depth and breadth and gravity and nature that it's likely impossible that you can fix them from within. So you've got to start from fresh because you can't clear the air in any other way. And that model gets used all the time. In, it is the point that the church is like other institutions and not totally like other institutions, but you know, the head of Enron is gone, the head of Arthur Anderson is gone, prime ministers go. So there is a long tradition that major failure on watch results in people stepping down. That's, I think, the model that people are using. Mari?
Yeah, you mentioned that the development of the 20th century Catholic moral teaching, that especially in Vatican II, there was an ecclesiological dimension to the switch there, such that the prophetic voice of the church depended upon an ecclesiological shift, in a sense. And I'm wondering, in your distinctions made regarding the contemporary crisis, that the moral element was specified just to speak about evil done to specific people in terms of that sort of the abuse itself. But it seems to me that in this case...
you're talking about the case of sexual abuse.
Yeah, when you said there were five issues here.
Right.
First one being the moral issue.
Right.
And that moral issue being evil done to specific individuals. But I'm wondering if, in this case as well, there's a moral responsibility to deal with ecclesiological issues, mm-hmm. such that the prophetic voice depends upon that ecclesiological distinction.
Well, that's what I mean by saying there's a theological, juridical dimension to this. Yeah, there is. In other words, in the first instance, this is about evil done to individuals. My view of it is the church is now in the midst of the cross, but parts of the church brought the cross on the church. And we brought the cross on the church by bringing the cross upon other people's lives in a massive way. So that's where it started. If you ask me, could you handle this by casuistry? That is to say, could you handle it only by individual cases and add them up? No, I don't think you can. I mean, there's a pattern here. That's why it's about governance, too. There's a pattern here that clearly must be part of the problem. Now, in the end, institutional patterns don't produce moral evil automatically, so that it takes someone to do it. But the fact of the matter is that there is an institutional pattern sufficiently evident that requires major address to that question. I mean, my own view methodologically is that you do need freestanding, maybe too strong a word, but you need independent commissions of adequate professional skill that provide the transparency to the internal workings of the church. I mean, you don't want to say religious groups shouldn't govern themselves. I mean, that could be a dangerous church-state problem in the end. I mean, I think the Attorney General here was a little bit out to lunch when he decided to devaluate the seminarians. But I mean, the fact is that while that one doesn't fly, the fact is that the transparency factor means that you maintain legitimate independence, but you open up channels. And I think independent commissions are the swing group between the church on the one hand and civil society on the other, where you can depend upon certain kinds of knowledge, certain kinds of experience, certain kinds of procedures that detail how cases will be dealt with and outcomes can be assessed. David, and then I think I had another hand over here.
It pains me greatly to spend a lot of time on these issues, but we have to.
We do now, yeah. Risky business.
It's not exactly a job that one leaps forward with enthusiasm to do. But I do think that it's, you're mentioning about a variety of things like independent commissions and so forth. I think that more fundamentally is an issue of a way of really
I think I that on the whole, that's right.
Questions on that issue of the routine pattern.
Right.
Of here.
I think basically you're right in what you've said. My sense is the point that you've raised is operationalizing it. That is to say, I think the difficulty we're going to have is that you will have a greater chance of building a certain consensus in this local church, meaning at least in this nation, than you're going to have of building the kind of consensus that it usually takes to move what Trelsch understood was a highly complicated, very structured reality. And I think part of the resistance to that is going to be just what you've said, on the one hand, and also the sense that, that you know, within the Roman Catholic Church, there is a kind of balance of power issues. I don't mean the Pope versus others. I mean local churches vis-a-vis local churches. The Vatican, on the whole, is always worried about the church in the United States and the church in Brazil throwing its weight around. Big churches overwhelming others. So there's a kind of inherent resistance to saying their problems are not the problems of the whole church. Now, the point is that can be way overstated. But I do think there'll be a real problem in terms of how you move from what you could do here in a consensus to abroad. Don, and well, one second, John. Let me.
I'll come back.
All right. Well.
This is somewhat the same question as David just asked. But I feel that one of the main reasons why people aren't leaving the church in great numbers at this point is because they have great confidence that we really are going to handle the moral dimension of it, the legal dimension of it, the administrative dimension of it. The shock has been so terrific, but the wheels have begun to turn. Are we getting to get those three dimensions under control, and we're probably going to do it. The ones that bother me more are the theological ones. And there, I think those are only going to be addressed, and they're only going to be resolved, provided that the Vatican gets involved. And that means that our own bishops have to take the initiative. Make sure that this is going to get worldwide addressed. There are problems with seminaries, there are problems with selecting priests, the question of homosexuality and its relations to the priesthood. Those can't be handled on a diocesan or regional basis. And what confidence do you have that they're really going to do anything with the Vatican?
Yeah. Well,
and if we don't address those effectively,
right. I mean, basically, I think your breakdown of the issues is right in the sense of none of them are easy, but relatively easy as opposed to really foundational. And when you get to the foundational issues, you would have to get to the question of women in the church, and you just have to get that. I think where the bishops are right this minute, my view. This and a quarter will get you to Harvard Square on the red line, but I mean, my view is that they are so knocked off balance on the first three right this minute that all the emphasis is on that. And if they can put together a coherent plan to deal with this that is universally binding, credible, transparent, and effective, that will give them enormous confidence. I mean, you've got to, right this minute, you've got to get them back on track. You've got to get them back where they feel, I mean, Bishop, who was it? I think it was Bishop Mulvey from Rhode Island said, I wake up at 3:00 in the morning, I know I'm going to get my feet back on the ground sometime, but when are we going to do it? Well, I mean, you've got to get out of that posture. You've got to get to the point where you feel, again, you're sort of in possession of yourself and your fundamental responsibilities to your diocese. Once that is done, I mean, I'm not saying this is all staged, but I'm saying if you didn't get that done, I don't think they'd have any ability to go and raise the larger case with the Universal Church. But if you get that much, if they can take some steps that both they feel they've done something. And the wider society, you know, the editorials in the Time, New York Times and the Washington Post begin to say it's being done rather than saying this is a catastrophe. If you get to that point, then I think the possibility exists of saying, and by the way, these are not purely legal, administrative, or even purely moral problems. It has surfaced for us a different set of questions. We see some things we didn't see before, and therefore it is now time to take what we've seen and try and share it. The question then would be how to do it. I think, you know, the betting man's view would be you would need a new papacy and a new time. Maybe not. Maybe not. I do think this man has an extraordinary capability when he's really focused on something to do things differently. But I do think that step, the theological juridical step, is not just about getting the right answer. It's about how you get the right answer filtered through a series of steps. You would understand that. I have a lady here that's been very patient, and I'll come across. Well, my view is, I think David's right that you can't address these things making believe this other 800-pound gorilla is sitting in the room. But I also would not be of the view of concentrating all our resources on this question. We've got to go about our daily business. We've got to do what the church ought to do. And what I was really trying to say at the end of the talk is, I think doing what we ought to do well, with a kind of rededicated commitment and with intelligibility and insight, and on the, doing that is one way back to rebuilding. But it's never an either or. You couldn't be so good, so insightful on poverty, war, etc., that you wouldn't have to deal with these other issues. Secondly, I don't think you can deal with these other issues as there is nothing else we can deal with until we've dealt with this. I think that overstates the case. That wouldn't be right. Vin?
Is that just as you were understandably circumspect in answering the question with regard to cardinal roles of power, every bishop, archbishop, and cardinal has that same burden.
That's true.
With regard to questioning authority. You know, it's a culture that my generation was certainly raised with, but which is, I just wonder where the prophetic witness comes from that effects the change that we need.
Well, it is a very good question. My sense is, I'm not positive that for me it's a question of not questioning authority. I think it's a question of where you do it from. In other words, I think given where I am, if I'm convinced the cardinal ought to resign, what I ought to do is to go see the cardinal. You know, face to face, one on one, and say, I know who you are and I know who I am, and I've got to tell you, this is my best judgment. That's what you ought to do. Now, someone else who's not a priest in the service of this diocese, sort of on duty, in place, could go to the New York Times and say, this is what ought to be done. I do think if they were in a different place in the church, that's an appropriate mode of doing it. And I'm not positive it is appropriate for me to do it that way. It is appropriate for me to do it the way I said, so that I'm not positive it is the unwillingness to question authority. It's a question that in questioning authority, you've got to both deal with the what are you questioning, the who you're speaking to, and the who you are and where you are in the system. And I mean, the church is different, and the Holy Spirit moves and moves you to specific prophetic stances. But I've spent a lot of time studying the political process along this way, you know. And there is a huge set of problems. Another one of my great favorite stories is a guy named Jim Thompson, who was the China East Asia specialist on Mac Bundy's national security staff. And he thought the war was wrong for ages and ages. And Thompson, after he had left the government, he wrote about it. And he said the trouble was he would go home every night and talk to his wife and say, you know, should I leave tomorrow and publish this piece? Or if I leave tomorrow, is Bundy going to put anybody in there who's going to say no to what he wants to do, what they want to do, left and right? So it's a question of sort of place to some degree, as well as what you say. And I don't want to make it sort of gentility or courtesy. For me, it is bonds of different kinds of obligations, conflicting and complementary obligations in what you do. At an earlier point in my career, I was both teaching moral theology and in a parish, and Humanae Vitae came up. And my view was that you had to at least communicate to the wider church the best theological knowledge that was available on that question, and I did not think all the best theological knowledge sat on the side of support of the papal conclusion. And that was, it seemed to be, both theologically and pastorally necessary to help people to understand that. Now, that was getting fairly close. I mean, it seemed to me that someone in the pastoral office was both responsible for communicating what had been articulated as the authoritative teaching of the church, and you were responsible for communicating to the wider public that the authoritative teaching of the church was in the minority, both in terms of a lead opinion, theologically, and in terms of existential decision-making by people. So I felt obliged, and I felt that was appropriate to do, and then I felt my superiors had to decide whether, having done that, I should be allowed to maintain public ministry. But it had gotten to that point, and so I did it. I mean, you know, I preached and talked and said, but that's a little different than I think this case is somewhat different than. But I think the authority question, obviously, in Catholicism is always hard. Engineer?
Yes, I'm embarrassed in this group of very educated and verbal people because I'm only a thinker and a lonely writer. I write folk songs. But God,
they may help right now.
They help me.
We may need one or two.
And it's a gift from God because I don't have to teach anymore. But I just want to bring out the fact that I was always much in love, really, as only a woman can be, with a brain. And if one of them was Pius the 12th, the other was Paul the 6th. And I go back to things that these priests have said. I think of them as priests. And the simplicity of the truth that they got. And I can remember Pius the 12th before he was made a horrifying image of medical malpractice and his dying, if you all recall that. And I do. I'm very emotional. I'm a poet. And I get terribly tied up with the way he suffered in his dying because his doctors played games with him to see what kind of drugs. Do you remember that, Father? Pius the 12th. And it was horrifying. But all my prayers, I hope, helped, and I'm sure I'm going to hug him up in heaven. But I go back again. Pius the 12th, I remember once in his writing, said, when I have a problem, I don't go to the psychiatrist. Jesus Christ used to talk to her, man to woman and God to lady. And she asked him questions. And he said, vengeance is mine, says the Lord. We do not crucify our priests publicly. They are still angels. You know, they have been, precious people to God and to Christ and to us because they are lit as candles. Now, when their candles gutter and become defamed and everything, it is not for the world to punish them. I will repay, says the Lord. Remember? And I'm just quoting Catherine. She sounded like a man on a pulpit.
We'll talk about the saints after.
Read
I'll
her.
Take one more.
My view about the institutional church is that it's a blessing and a burden. And you sometimes feel the weight of it, and at other times you feel the support of it. Precisely because of the first 80% of my talk, which is to say how the gospel is to be related to modern life in society, where we've got the military capacity to blow up the created order, we've got the material capacity to satisfy basic human needs, and the world lives in radical disparity, where genocide has reappeared twice in a century, three times in a century. In that kind of world, the church needs, I think, to be both insightful, intelligent, passionate, and large and institutional if you're going to deal with that kind of world. And so the institution, to my mind, is from that perspective, is necessary. It is also a burden. It is also a burden because it can get in the way of doing the very things that you need that need to be done. So that's the first thing. The second thing is, I think there is a cultural question here. American culture is not easily summarized. It's not easily understood from the inside, so trying to understand it from the outside. I remember Archbishop McGrath from Panama, who was one of the members of the Theological Commission of the of Vatican II, the Central Theological Commission, and he was talking once with a French cardinal who worked in the Curia, and they were talking about academic freedom. They were talking about freedom, and the French cardinal said, when those Americans talk about freedom, I have no understanding of what they mean. I mean, it's kind of like it's just, it sounds like a license. I mean, he didn't say that, but really that was the implication. It's just there is something about that culture that doesn't sort of fit into the normative governance of the way we run things. So I think there's a cultural question. I think there's also this balance of power question, which to some degree I think is actually healthy. I mean, in other words, if you live in the one superpower in the world, you shouldn't be a superpower church. I mean, that the church should run on different logic than the state system. It's enough to be the superpower in the state system. We ought to be, what we are is not universally the leading question of what everyone else has to do. I think that's okay. So a certain amount of skepticism about our problems from the center of the church, in that sense, I think is okay. But like anything else, it can be pushed too far, and that is to say precisely church this large, this potentially significant, can't be simply ignored. So then you come back.
back to the question that we need some modesty as this local church. We need some sense of both the distinctive characteristics that we live with and the wider picture of the world we're trying to relate to, the Catholic world and the world as a whole. And I think we need to speak our own truth as forcefully as we can. That, I think, is Don's point. Yeah, speak it as forcefully and civilly as you can. And then recognize that even if we've got that truth, getting it accepted is a very significant challenge in an institution like ours. But it's worth the effort. I mean, to me, you know, the great people of the 20th century for the Roman Catholic Church were that group of people, Kangar, Golubar, Danielu, Murray. Those are people who that institutional church told them they were wrong. They told them they were wrong. They told them that they were threatening what was good about the church, and that basically they were in error. And they abided that stricture, but they never stopped pursuing what they knew was the truth. And then came a moment when they could speak the truth. So sometimes it's a mix of continuing to hold on to what you know is right, what you're convinced is right, anyway, in the face of people telling you you're wrong and you're threatening and damaging, but do it in a style that allows you to sort of stay in the arena. So when the moment comes to open up the best you have to offer, you're around and you're not gone. And that, I think, is probably a useful example for the church as a whole.
Applause really says it all, but maybe I can just say one more thing, and that is that I've been, it's my third year now at Boston College, and I came here with great joy and delight at being part of a Catholic university. My first year here, I had to deal with Ex Quaede Ecclesiae, which my friends in academia, generally speaking, thought was a terrible idea and wondered how I could come to a Catholic university when that was on the agenda. Now, this year, I'm dealing with the issues that we're all dealing with, and again, my friends, not only now in academia, but in all walks of life, wonder exactly what you're doing here, Alan, and what's going on. And I can only say that I love this institution, and I love the church of which it's a part for at least two reasons. One is that it produces people like Father Hare, and indeed the whole Society of Jesus, and their extraordinary intellectuality. Their amazing grasp of philosophy and theology and history, and can put together the kind of talk that we heard tonight is just testimony to an extraordinarily rich intellectual tradition and a serious moral tradition as well. And the other reason is because of people like you in the audience, lay people, parishioners, people who care deeply about your church, are moved to speak about it in such a morally serious way that I think it is really, truly remarkable. This was a very, very special evening. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.